Psalm 119, part of which I read with you this morning, is the longest of the hymns in the Bible. Its 176 verses are set out in an acrostic form. Each stanza of eight lines is begun by a succeeding letter of the alphabet. And the whole is an extended, one-themed praise of law, the Torah, God's law. Judaism is a religion of laws. Obedience to the law is one of the supreme virtues inculcated by the faith. In fact, I'm quite sure that if we're one to research every line of the scripture, one could even find a stanza here or there which would seem to give aid and comfort to those who used law and order in the recent political debate as a code word for absolute submission to all authority. I can, for instance, imagine ex-Governor Wallace encouraging and insisting that every school child in the state of Alabama learn this phrase: "My son, fear the Lord and the King, and meddle not with those that seek change." You know, and I know, that ours is not a quietistic faith. We are restive under injustice, angry with discriminatory or inadequate or unrighteous laws. We have never taught that we should render unto Caesar all obeisance, those things which belong to Caesar, without criticism, without dissent, without challenge. And indeed, when we look to this section in Proverbs, we find that it is not so much an extensive philosophy of the law as a rather narrow bit of prudential wisdom designed for the well-born, the noble few, a warning to them not to meddle in the endless and feckless intrigues of Middle Eastern courts. That way there is danger and death and useless conflict. Listen to the entire context of this doublet. "My son, fear the Lord and the King, and meddle not with those that seek change. For overthrow may come from them at any moment, and who knows what calamity either one may send." Judaism has no patience for all of its respect for law, with an unquestioning acquiescence to arbitrary authority. What I came to call during the last campaign the law and ordernicks, those who argue that we must be submissive and silent before any inappropriate regulation, before the worst kind of unrighteous act, before privilege and arbitrary power, will find no comfort in our faith. And yet, despite the use to which these words law and order were put, the misuse, rather, to which they were put, the words have meaning, and their meaning is prized by our tradition. We are a religion of law. Our very Bible is called Torah, the law. That religious disciplines are not so much pietistic as legal, halakha, the way a man should go. The very word which we use for a good deed, to do a mitzvah, is a word whose root meaning means commandment and law. And perhaps alone among the great religious systems, some of the most classic of our religious texts have been law books. the Mishnah, the Gemara, which comprised the Talmud, Maimonides' Mishnah Torah, the great medieval code, the Shulchan Aruch. Traditional Judaism then does not give aid and comfort either to those who would restrain a submissive society or to those who argue, as do some of our contemporaries, in the name of what they call radical freedom. Now, insofar as I understand this term, radical freedom implies that laws are, of course, man-made, and that they are agencies by which power and privilege manipulate the institutions of a society to restrain, to hold down the less privileged, those groups who are still without the law. Those who argue for radical freedom argue that all laws are by definition burdensome and discriminatory, that man must live in a state of freedom or he will somehow organize his relationships by the rule of love, by some kind of sensitivity or kindness. The code words here are by an I-thou relationship where we will see other people as they are, not as pawns to be manipulated for the good of our good or the good of the state. They argue that until man is free from all restraint, from all rule and regulation, there will be anger festering within the soul of man, there will be bitterness poisoning the heart of man, and we will know the violence and the unrest which are so much a part of our contemporary scene. Now, traditional Judaism would call such ideas naive and innocent. Traditional Judaism would argue that far from being simply a restraint, law is a social necessity. Indeed, that it is only through law that men can become free. The ultimate paradox, the ultimate truth, surprisingly, is that it's only through laws, through regulations, that we achieve freedom. Listen to some of the typical statements of our tradition. Pray for the welfare of the government. Were it not for the welfare of the ruler, every man would devour his fellow alive. A large fish swallows small fish. So would man were he not restrained by the government. Yatsab chok lo olam, natan durya lo olam. When law came into the world, freedom came into the world. Our tradition would argue from the evidence of history that whenever arbitrary rule, the rule of man supersedes the rule of law, a state is regulated by bribery and by the black market. It is not what you do, but whom you know. It is not what your value is to the society as the whole, but what your value is to the elite who rule the group. In any arbitrary society, men are always in danger of being snatched out of their homes or picked up off the street, quite arbitrarily, without any right to complain against their seizure. And traditional Judaism would argue also that until there is regulation, there is no freedom. What would happen, for instance, if all of us in this city decided that we were going to pilot our cars exactly as we saw fit, where we went, wanted to go, by the shortest direction, as fast as we wanted to go? We determined that we were going to pay no attention to the stop signs, to the lights, and to all the other traffic regulations. Judaism would argue that within a very short time, the more than 2 million cars belonging to the Clevelanders would clog our streets. We would all be hopelessly snarled and entangled in a traffic mess, and none of us would be able to move. Our very radical freedom destroying our freedom to go from place to place. And it is, in fact, only by our willingness, our consent to the traffic laws that we can have the freedom to move about this place. And so it is in so many of the relationships of life, argues our tradition. When is man free to produce music? Only when he has mastered the laws of theory and the laws of harmony and the rules of keyboard technique. Only then do the notes mean something more than the punch card of a player piano. When can man be free within a family? If there are no rules and there are no regulations, there can be no privacy. And if there is no privacy, there is no freedom. When can civilization develop? Only when society has rules and regulations which protect the activity of those who do not produce goods. What rights would I have to the fruit of my mind? How would I feed my family if I were an artist or a writer, if there were not copyright laws to protect my work from sudden Xeroxing and mass distribution by those who did not have to do any more than pick up a copy of what I'd written and send it about? Indeed, one would argue, if one argues from the base of our tradition, that it is precisely because we do not yet have a system of international law and sanction that we have this impossible ugliness which we call international relationships. Yatsa chok lo'olam, natan durya lo'olam. When law came into the world, then freedom comes into the world. What does our tradition say about the argument that man can be self-regulating? That the law of love, that sensitivity, feeling, care, compassion, will somehow make up for the absence of rules and regulations? Our tradition would simply say that all these virtues are in fact virtues. They are the oil which a social fabric requires. Without them, life is a jungle, red of tooth and claw. But that they are not sufficient in this world of ours to be the ultimate regulatory principle. Let me make my point. Judaism would call such thinking apocalyptic, which means as if it were dealing not with the world as we know it, the here and the now, but with the end of days. The Bible, as you know, has a vision, a messianic vision. It deals with a moment in time when God will somehow transform this world into something better than it is now. And it shall come to pass in the end of days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established upon the top of the mountains, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation. There's going to be not only a transvaluation of values, but a transformation of human nature. The lamb and the lion will sit down together. The child can play on the poison adder's den, and none shall make them afraid. But this is not in the here and now, but in the future, when man somehow, according to this vision, will be granted a lev hadash, a new heart. In this world, in our world, there's greed, there's violence, there's bitterness, there's pathology, and man must have protection against all of these cruelties which intrude upon the idol of childhood, but upon the images of innocence. After all, ours is not the end of days. Ours is a day in which the most civilized nation on the face of the earth organize the mass destruction of millions upon millions of its people. And for such a society, the tradition would argue, law is urgently necessary. Yatsa chok lo'olam natan durya lo'olam. Only when law enters the world does freedom enter the world. Now, of course, this is not the whole of it. Judaism does not argue that we must be submissive to unjust law, that we must be passive in the face of all authority. There is another side to the coin. But what we're dealing here is not a simple question, but the ultimate complexity, the ultimate tension which faces every society. How does one balance out the ultimate requirement, the necessity, the urgency of a society to live under the rule of law, and the urgent feeding of men, that laws must constantly be improved, reshaped, restructured, so that they deal with a larger and broader, purer concept of justice. Let me turn again to Psalm 119, this extended paean of praise to law. You have to read a long way into the psalm, but when you get to verse 126, you come across a very interesting stanza. It reads this way: Eit la'asot l'Adonai heferu sorasecha. A literal translation, and the correct one given its context, is this: It is a time now for God to act, because they, presumably evildoers, have rebelled against or forsaken his law. But there is another possible translation if one takes this phrase out of its context and simply looks at its syntax. And that translation would be this: Eit la'asot l'Adonai, when it is time to be active for God, heferu sorasecha, then put aside your law. In other words, that there are moments in time when it is necessary to protect the law by violating the law, to go beyond the law in order to safeguard the law. And the Talmud gives several instances of what it has in mind. It tells, for instance, of this rule, which was part of the law of ancient Israel. The high priest might not wear his sacred garments any place outside of the temple compound. That is Torah law. But it so happens in the 4th century before the Common Era, when Alexander the Great was sweeping with his armies across all of Asia Minor, the man who was the high priest of the temple, the ruler of Judea at the time, a man named Shimon HaTzadik, Simon the Just, put on his garments, his sacred garments, and left the temple compound and left the city of Jerusalem in order to meet Alexander the Great at the head of his army some many leagues away to ask Alexander to spare the city. He needed the robes of his dignity and of his office in order to impress Alexander with his authority in order to make his case. And the Talmud says very simply, Eit la'asot l'Adonai heferu sorasecha. When it is time to save the city, to protect the sanctuary, then you can set aside the law. It's perfectly legitimate and perfectly proper. It gives another instance. 5 centuries later, in the 2nd century of the Common Era, the Emperor Hadrian, the Roman Emperor, organized a massive retaliation against the Jewish rebellion, and he prohibited almost every activity which we associate with Jewish religion. He prohibited the very study of the law, of the Torah, and those sages who taught the law were subject to immediate execution. Now, until that time, it had been the law in Israel that one could not write down what is called the Agadah, the metaphysical speculations, the philosophy, the myth, the legendary material of Jewish life. The fear was that in those days where there were few books and people venerated the book and ascribed to it great value simply because it was written, that someone would see one of these speculations and call it normative, call it definitive, and make it central in their religious system. And they were, after all, only individual opinions. But in the 2nd century, the rabbis violated this old law and began to write the Agadah down because they argued, unless we set it down, Rome may catch up with all of the teachers. Only the scholars know the law. There'll be no one left to know the Agadah. There'll be no one left to teach the Agadah, and it will disappear from our midst. Eit la'asos l'Adonai heferu torasecha. When it is time to do something which is required for the sake of the faith, for the sake of God, then you are allowed deliberately to violate the law. Judaism, of course, beyond these specific instances, has enshrined within the scripture the original cult of descent, the prophetic cult. The prophets were the great exponents of civil disobedience. When the king ordered the armies to attack Egypt, the prophets rose up and denounced the king for engaging in Vietnam when there were problems in the city. The prophets were the originators of what we call today symbolic speech, the demonstration. They didn't hold up placards because the average person couldn't read in those days. But when Jeremiah wanted to tell the people that if they continued to engage in foreign wars, the country would be sacked by some enemy and they'd all be taken away captive, he suddenly appeared on the cities of Jerusalem with the yoke in which prisoners of war were kept, his hands manacled to that yoke, and he wore it all about the city in silent protest, effective protest against the king's rule. And the prophets, some of them were willing to say that when a society became so evil, so morally corrupt, that it could not solve the problems of the poor, it would not listen to the cries of the widow and the orphan, it deserved to be destroyed. It deserved to be torn down. And in fact, so the prophets spoke against ancient Judea. So we have in our tradition, on the one hand, veneration of the law, respect for its necessity, and on the other hand, a tradition of dissent and of civil disobedience. Can we bring these two into some kind of juxtaposition? How do they balance out? Well, they can balance out only in the heart of man, because they are ultimately logically opposites. How can they be balanced? In the first place, I would suggest that Judaism, by and large, is leery of civil disobedience. Between an unjust law and anarchy, Judaism, I believe, would counsel submission to the unjust law. Judaism recognized that revolution can topple the ancient evils in a society, but it replaces some rule by the rule of men, and until that the rule of men becomes again a rule of law, everyone in the society is in fact in jeopardy. The French Revolution toppled the Ancien Régime, and then after a great bloodbath and the terror and a moment of popular freedom, what happened? Napoleon, the reinstitution of autocracy, the imposition of arbitrary dictatorship. Revolution often destroys at great human cost without rebuilding in a way that is of greater benefit to more men. And by and large, our tradition was leery of any continuous attack on a society unless that society were so corrupt and so rotten that it ought not to survive. Judaism would have no danger, no difficulty in justifying any act of illegality against Nazi Germany, against any authoritarian regime which was capricious and violent. But I'm not quite sure, despite many instinctive sympathies, how Judaism would react to some of the language and the escalation of violence which has been raised against this own nation of ours. Because this is not an autocratic nation. This is a nation of law. This is not a nation where the law operates capriciously. It is not always just by a long shot. But no juster society has ever been evolved. And in this nation of ours, there are mechanisms built into the political structure which allow for change, allow for modification, allow for the reshaping and the refashioning of society. And I am sure of this, that the ancient sages would have said, until you are convinced that every one of the avenues of due process has been exhausted, until you are convinced that you have tried the legal system and found it blocked and shut to you, until you are convinced that what you are advocating is in fact holy and just and urgent, until that moment, beware of an attack upon the legal guts of the society, for you may end up by destroying the body politic, by destroying the greatest freedom that men have ever known. Now, this is not to say that our society is a just one. This is not to say that our laws do not need reshaping. This is not to say that those who are in charge of the court system, who manage the legislative branch, the representatives and the people that they represent, are under a terrible obligation to move fast enough and deliberately enough and radically enough within the system to bring in the poor, the racially outcast, the dispossessed, and to grant them a full measure of their rights. It is to say that unless this radical reshaping from within the system takes place, those who argue against this system in its entirety will win the day. Because they have going for them not only their own sense of what is morally urgent and right, but the anger and the passion of those who have been for so long denied. But Judaism would argue, I believe, if we can, and we must, if we can use the system to reform the system, this is the way. Because ultimately, none of us has any security within the state except the security that law affords us. The big fish is always there to swallow up the small fish. The majority is always there to impose its will upon the minority. The group is always there to impose its authority upon the individual. The individual, the minority, the few, are only safeguarded by the majesty and the process and the proper operation of law. Law has great value. It is the very substance of a society. Permits the freedom a society knows. Only a society of law is free. But no society of law can sit back and say, Dayenu, this is the law. It is final and ultimate. This is the way it has been and it must be. It cannot be changed. Those who are denied will be denied. Those of privilege will be maintained in their privilege. Such an action only invites moral outrage and condemnation, the prophetic denunciation, and ultimately the rebellious act. Let me close by being quite personal. We are all on the other, most of us are on the other side of the generation gap. Most of us belong in one way or another to the establishment. Such powers individuals have within our society lies within our hands. If you leave this congregation convinced that Judaism condemns the rebel because it holds him to be naive in feeling that somehow the sweet innocence of freedom will establish a better society than we know now, beware that this is all that you take out with you. For the other statement, the other half of the coin is this. We have a rich and glorious heritage. We have a great deal of freedom. But these freedoms will not be maintained or sustained unless we, the adult, the established, the in, unless we so use our energies now, not a decade from now, urgently, not arguing that we have time to research the reforms over another long period of time, unless we use every ounce of wisdom and political power and energy at our disposal in order to strike from the books those laws which are vestiges of a day of apartheid, to reshape those laws which establish rights of property above rights of person, to reshape those laws which maintain the inability of some people to move into the mainstream of American life, those laws which make for the anger and the frustration and the bitterness which is eating away the vital organs of our body politic. The urgency is very real. And though our tradition comes down solidly for law and order, it adds urgently the word justice, and it argues persuasively that an unjust society breeds its own destruction.